You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Miley Cyrus on the cover. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here are some of this month's contributors. Ryan McGinley, Miley Everlasting. McGinley, who had a solo show at the Whitney at age 25, photographed Miley Cyrus outside an industrial sand plant in the Everglades, where the two listened to music, danced, and shared pictures of their pets. Cyrus once bought one of McGinley's photos at a gala for AIDS research, outbidding Tom Ford. "I've always had a big place in my heart for her," says the photographer. Zach Barron, Miley Everlasting. "There are so few artists who actually command the attention of the country, and Miley Cyrus has been one of them for nearly a decade," says Barron, a staff writer at GQ who toured Versace's Miami mansion with the singer. "Everyone acts extremely strange and self-conscious the second they see her, which is always fascinating for a writer." Karen Mahajan, the god of corrupt things. "As an Indian, I'm fascinated by the role Indians have played as middlemen in Africa," says Mahajan. He was particularly drawn to the story of the Gupta brothers in South Africa and the ways they broke with or exaggerated that dynamic. Mahajan's novel, The Association of Small Bombs, was a finalist for the 2016 National Book Award. Kenzie Bryant, Red Hatter. Bryant, a staff writer at Vanity Fair since 2016, was blown away while interviewing Atlanta star Zazie Beetz. "I feel like I grew as a person while talking to her," says Bryant. She has a bright future as a life coach if this acting thing doesn't work out. Thank you. Now here's the March 2019 editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief. The elements of style. In the photos, Vanity Fair executive fashion director Samira Nasser styles Miley Cyrus during the shoot in Miami, and Ryan McGinley photographs Cyrus. A big part of the fun of editing Vanity Fair is that through our reporting and our events, I have the opportunity to meet actors I've long admired on screen. This January, I met Selma Blair. As Julie Miller writes in her profile, Selma was a fashion muse before celebrity stylists were a thing. Her innate style sense and strength of personality made her a natural fit for designers from Karl Lagerfeld to Stella McCartney. Last year, Selma was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis after 5 years or so of enduring mysterious symptoms that she could neither explain nor get anyone to take seriously, including, for quite some time, herself. She is a working single parent who is now also a powerful voice for people coping with the practical challenges brought about by physical disabilities. And she is just as worthy of the label fashion muse as she was when her career was beginning 2 decades ago. That's why we wanted to feature her in our spring style issue with iconic black and white portraits shot by Cass Bird. Selma speaks eloquently of the transformative power of fashion, the way it affirms and expresses one's identity, and she has taken her diagnosis as a chance to speak up for people who might feel unseen or underserved by the fashion industry, as well as the world at large. She has become more ambitious both in her advocacy and her acting, all while remaining her sharp, witty, adventurous self. My admiration for her only grows, as it does for Miley Cyrus, our cover star. At 26, she's over-indexed on accomplishments. I write this letter the morning after she shared the stage with Dolly Parton at the Grammys and acquitted herself beautifully on a duet of Jolene, which makes her pretty much a goddess in my book. But she's also grown out of her child stardom into some very adult circumstances, which run the gamut from catastrophic to celebratory. The loss of the Malibu home she and Liam Hemsworth shared in the Woolsey fire last autumn, followed by her marriage to Hemsworth in December. Those two events are related, she tells Zach Barron in a profile that ranges from her new album in progress to her sexuality, to, yes, that controversial Vanity Fair photograph 11 years ago. The heartbreak over their home became a sort of glue between them. She doesn't mention a phoenix rising from the ashes, but she doesn't have to. Ryan McGinley captures that spirit in his photographs of her, a woman in her element, whatever that element may be. Her style is as versatile as her talent. She talks with Zach in vintage Versace, bears her heart in Saint Laurent, and wades into warm Miami waters in Chanel. Then there's Zazie Beetz, whom you may know from her starring roles in FX's Atlanta or Deadpool 2, but who wears lots of hats these days, both on screen, with upcoming roles in X-Force and Joker, and in our shoot, also by Cass Bird, this time in dreamy color. Riding the subways of New York City, Zazie commutes effortlessly between chic and sweet. She's got a huge year ahead, along with all the rising stars in this issue, but in our eyes, they're already tops. opening act. Danielle McDonald speaks with Vanity Fair's Krista Smith. Opening photo by Lauren Dukoff, styled by Deborah Afshani. I'm hoping for a rom-com resurgence. There's horrible stuff happening in the world. I need to escape and have a little hope, says Danielle McDonald, 27, star of the recent Netflix films Bird Box and Dumplin'. And in quotes from the fan club, Dolly Parton says, I admire how she takes care of herself, how she presents herself, and her own self-confidence. From Sandra Bullock, this smart, funny, deeply talented actor who can seriously bust a move is ego-free. And from Awkwafina, Danielle is the real deal. She has an ownership of her craft like I have never seen. Growing up in Australia, did you always have your sights set on Hollywood? Did you come from an acting family? No, my mom's an accountant and my dad is in shipping, but I was obsessed with movies. When I was little, I used to make my dad stop at the video store on the way home. Then it became, what are we renting on iTunes? What were your favorite things to watch? Clueless, Legally Blonde, Mean Girls. They were the rom-coms of my teenagehood. There aren't that many anymore, so I'm hoping for a rom-com resurgence. There's a lot of horrible stuff happening in the world. Give me a good rom-com, please. I need to escape and have a little hope. I watch movies based on what I want to be feeling, and I never liked horror. It scares me too much, so I just avoid it. But Bird Box is a horror film, and it's truly terrifying. I don't think it's terrifying, but that's because I know everything that happens. When we filmed a scene where a car goes over someone's head, they just had spaghetti sauce shooting out. It's funny because it's so not ahead. I kind of ruined the horror for myself. In the past year, you starred as Jennifer Aniston's Dolly Parton-obsessed daughter in Dumplin' and alongside Sandra Bullock in Bird Box. What was it like to work with them? I remember hearing, you're going to be working with Jennifer Aniston. She's going to be your mom. It's crazy. It's not normal. But then you meet Jen, and she is normal. Jen and Sandra Bullock may seem like these iconic, untouchable actresses, but they are just warm people who want to connect and work with you on a level that is equal. I learned you have to be equal on set, otherwise you can't find that connection. You broke out at the Sundance Film Festival in 2017 with Patty Cakes, and you returned to the festival this year with Paradise Hills, co-starring Awkwafina, Emma Roberts, Isa Gonzalez, and Mila Jovovich. Tell me about making this movie. It's this visually stunning film about girls at a wellness center, and you find out something more sinister is going on. While we were shooting, I stayed in the same building as Awkwafina. She was just about to have the most incredible year of her life, and this was right after Patty Cakes, so we were like, what is happening? We really bonded, and the whole cast would go out together every Sunday for dinner. I love how each of your projects is so different. Coming up, you have the drama Skin, and after that, you're in the biopic I Am Woman about the Australian singer Helen Reddy. I know. Skin is a true, heavy story about neo-Nazis, but it's really a story of redemption and how people have to change. And in I Am Woman, I play the music journalist Lillian Roxon. She wrote the first ever encyclopedia of rock and helped establish careers like David Bowie's. What do you want to do next? I like challenging myself, and I want to do a bit of everything. When you get to play different characters, it's a whole new part of you that you didn't know existed. Screen share. Three new crime shows premiere this month. Sonia Soraya charts the overlap. The blank, a crime thriller starring a brunette. Okay, first, The Act on Hulu. Murdered woman, true crime, horrific abuse, dramatic courtroom scenes. One family member systematically defrauding another. Faking death or illness for profit. Patricia Arquette poisoning her own child. Joey King with a shaved head, based on a BuzzFeed news article. Now on Amazon Prime, The Widow. The blank, a crime thriller starring a brunette. One family member systematically defrauding another, faking death or illness for profit. Kate Beckinsale tackles international terrorism. Charles Dance and Alex Kingston star as sidekicks, suggesting the calm down already. White lady positioned in opposition to scary black man or men. Marriage, it's dangerous. And on ABC, The Fix. Executive producer Marcia Clark. A lawyer named The Wolf. L.A., then giving up and moving to Oregon. Full Plate. Luisa Strauss visits the home of José Andrés, the chef and activist whose High Temple to Spanish Cuisine opens this month. Even when Jose Andres isn't in the kitchen at one of his 31 restaurants across the U.S. and abroad, the Spanish-born chef is still tackling hunger. The restaurateur and humanitarian routinely charges to the front lines of disaster relief, feeding millions of hurricane victims in places like North Carolina, Puerto Rico, and Haiti, and earlier this year, unpaid federal workers in D.C. during the government shutdown. With this schedule at a rolling boil, the Nobel Peace Prize nominee has made his home in Bethesda, Maryland, a culinary sanctuary. This month, Andres opens Mercado Little Spain, a sprawling Spanish food hall in Manhattan's Hudson Yards. In the photographs by Laurel Golio, I grow sage, kale, parsley, and more in this farm shelf. It's very high-tech, but it's about the future. Our government is trying to protect us from the enemy coming from the south. In the meantime, we have romaine infected with salmonella attacking us from within. This plate is only for Spanish omelets. It's just potatoes and eggs, not those bullshit frittatas everybody freaks out about. I found these beehives on Kickstarter, where I seem to buy everything. The Flow Hive is a simple, ancient way of harvesting honey with new technology. The best way to eat anchovies is just like the seals do. Drop them into your mouth whole. Don't complicate it. Be like the seals. I love my clay pots. They're handmade in Spain, and I don't take them for granted because they are ephemeral and might break. I made this with Dale Chihuly next to me as my master. While I was blowing the glass, my tooth broke, and we believe it's still in there. This is the map of relief operations we set up in North Carolina during Hurricane Florence last year. We go there, we jump in, we do good. I have the first book about canning by Nicolas Appert from 1810, and another first edition by Bria Savarin, who was probably the Jules Verne of eating, who said, "Tell me what you eat, and I'll tell you who you are." Now, the Vanity Fair agenda, promotion, and events. Event: Vanity Fair celebrates Dior Lady Art 3. This past January, Vanity Fair and Dior welcomed guests to the brand's New York and Beverly Hills boutiques to celebrate Dior Lady Art 3, a limited edition handbag collaboration with female artists. Special guests were invited to shop the collection and listen to intimate talks with the artist. Condé Nast Archives director Ivan Shaw chatted with artist Pei White in Beverly Hills. In New York City, Gallery Girls blogger Jasmine Hernandez spoke to artist Polly Apfelbaum and Micheline Thomas. Event: Jane Walker by Johnny Walker unveils Signs of Progress exhibit. In celebration of Women's History Month, Jane Walker by Johnny Walker will be unveiling the Signs of Progress exhibit starting March 1st at the New York Historical Society in partnership with their Center for Women's History. The exhibit, up throughout the month of March, will feature signs preserved from women's marches across the nation, along with empowering signs commissioned by a collective of graphic artists. The body of work commemorates the spirit of collective progress moving our country forward. desert rising. At the kickoff to an art treasure hunt in the Coachella Valley, Desert X marks the spot for Artistic Explorers by Britt Hennemuth, with photographs by Peter Bowler. Rules don't always apply in the California desert. Not for Al Capone and Frank Sinatra, and not for Desert X artistic director Neville Wakefield. At the preview of the biennial exhibition up through April 21st, which brings large-scale contemporary art to the Coachella Valley, artists, curators, and gallery kids gathered at Mob Spot turned Wellness Center. Two Bunch Palms for an exclusive kickoff. I'm interested where art behaves outside of institutional walls, Wakefield said, and the desert offers a tradition. It's a place where people have been cast off, only to discover themselves. Braving nightfall's temperature dip, guest in Mad Max meets Reagan-era get-ups were treated to a performance by bird singers from the Agua Caliente band of the Cahuilla Indians, the people indigenous to Palm Springs, at the unveiling of Kathleen Ryan's Ghost Palm, one of the 19 works installed throughout the desert. Meanwhile, in line at the Make Your Own Pho Station, chatter about streaming, Bentleys, and art installers hummed over the live entertainment of world-renowned whistler Molly Lewis. For rule benders, art lovers, and soul searchers too, look no further than Desert X. In the photos, at the unveiling of Kathleen Ryan's Ghost Palm, an echo of the region's largest palm tree, Desert X artistic director Neville Wakefield said, "We commission art that is born out of the landscape so we can enter that conversation between nature and culture." A man assembles Dive-In, an architectural work in Palm Springs, Pink, by the Danish artist collective Superflex. And artists, curators, and board members enjoyed an intimate dinner at the Holiday House hosted by Lynn Winter.
Thank you.
on the beat. I love not having rules, says the multi-talented Anderson .Paak about his latest genre-defying album, Oxnard, his third and his first for Dr. Dre's Aftermath label. The singer, songwriter, rapper, and drummer is on a headlining arena tour this spring that includes an appearance at Coachella. Here, .Paak, 33, talks about his chaotic upbringing, marijuana, and church. By Lisa Robinson. How did you become such an accomplished drummer playing in church? Church was the best schooling I could have had. You can't learn it the same way going to college or paying for it. It's a spiritual process, the strong faith, the culture, just feeling the groove, feeling the choir out, knowing when to switch it up, its reflexes, instincts. You went from playing music in church to working at a weed farm, which seems like a weird seg. It's natural. God blesses us with the herb. I was doing God's work. But now I have to take breaks from weed because I get the munchies and gain weight. I once had a bad experience with edibles on a plane. I had a legit anxiety attack. My heart was racing. I thought I was going to die. Everyone was looking at me like I was on crack. Your music has no boundaries. There's jazz, soul, funk, rap. It's not interesting for me to make an album that's one thing or some retro thing that's been done before. I'm trying to keep it exciting for myself, for the people around me, and continue to get better. I love embracing all the genres people said we couldn't. On Oxnard, you have features from Dr. Dre, who also produced a lot of it, Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, Snoop Dogg, Busta Rhymes, Q-Tip, and others. Who got all of them to participate? That was me. These people don't have to answer the phone for anybody. Everyone is trying to work with them, but all of them came out of real relationships I had. I wanted to get the best artist I could. I wanted to go big with it. Your career is really taking off, and you're married with two kids. How do you balance that? A lot of myself is given to my music now. It's an obsession. If I didn't have my wife, I don't know how things would go. But I know that someone is there who's nurturing and taking care of these kids while I'm touring, and my two kids are mama's boys. What is .Paak House? It's the first initiative for my Brandon Anderson, .Paak's real name, foundation. I do stuff in my hometown, Oxnard, California, for low-income families. Eventually, I'd like to have a .Paak House in every city in the country, like the Boys and Girls Clubs. Your upbringing was chaotic. Your parents were both in jail. You've seen domestic abuse. Yet you seem so happy. How are you able to make such uplifting music? Maybe because I went through a lot of chaos and drama. I find humor in a lot of things. But I feel that things could be worse, and as long as you're breathing, you can smile. Even when I'm angry, I smile, but the smile can mean 10 different things. You have amazing teeth. Are they real? Yeah, they're real. I had braces when I was younger. I try to brush twice a day. I've got to maintain this reputation. I've got the best teeth in the game.
Thank you.
Onto Books, Style Shelf, 9 books that dwell in the world of aesthetics, from the fashions of Dublin streets to the sumptuous interiors of New York City. In almost 10 years of talking and working together with Bowie, I learned that he had a deep faith in art as cultural transformation. If a song were a pathway to another way of being or a different society, why not a magazine page? Wrote Dean Kuypers, journalist in the Raygun retrospective. I thought who I was, what I wore, when caught off my guard, was much more interesting than anything I could have planned. Also, I felt that my life, every thought I had, every gesture I made, was authentic. Wrote Isaac Mizrahi, author and designer, in his memoir. Ethan James Green is a counterculture portraitist, alive to a New York that still feels somehow like a freewheeling Wild West. His subjects, musicians and designers and all manner of creatives, are emissaries from a generation that has bushwhacked new expanses of gender expression and been reared on the self-curating powers of social media, wrote Irene F., model and actress, in the foreword to Green's monograph. In the photos by Allison Schaller and the 9 books, Eamon Doyle, Made in Dublin by Eamon Doyle and Kevin Barry, published by Thames and Hudson. I Am a Memoir by Isaac Mizrahi, published by Flatiron. Yves Saint Laurent Biography by Lawrence Benjamin, published by Rizzoli. Raygun, The Bible of Music and Style by Marvin Scott Jarrett, published by Rizzoli. John Richardson, At Home by John Richardson, published by Rizzoli. Ethan James Green, Young New York by Ethan James Green and Michael Shulman, published by Aperture. Traveler's Tales, Bags Unpacked, by Bertil Scali and Louis Vuitton, published by Thames and Hudson. Anti-Glossy, Fashion Photography Now, by Patrick Remy, published by Rizzoli. And Vitamin T, Threads and Textiles in Contemporary Art, by Janelle Porter, published by Phaidon. Thank you. Keziah Weir writes on style, Dreamweaver, a bold tote with a fresh aesthetic for warm weather wishers and a wistful style tribe, with photograph by Kiernan Monahan and Theo Vamvunakis. A Bottega Veneta checked bag in poppy mist. Philophiles rejoice. Those still mourning the departure of Phoebe Philo from Celine can delight in Bottega Veneta, where a young disciple of Philo's has taken the creative helm. Daniel Lee, the 33-year-old former director of ready-to-wear at Celine, brings an updated classic sensibility to Bottega Veneta, where he plans to maintain the label's ethos. Light on logos, heavy on understated elegance, while evoking youthful determination. In this debut bag, Lee has succeeded, expanding the Italian brand's signature intricato woven leather into a jumbo size. While a vivid pairing of red and white risk summoning unseasonable images of Christmas paraphernalia, this fresh iteration evokes only bright skies and springtime nostalgia. It is an elevated take on movie theater popcorn bags, carnival tents, picnic blankets. It is the tote Margot Tenenbaum might fashion out of her brother's red tracksuit. No Noel, just Joyeux in spades. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.